Hi, I'm Allison Kubo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
About 20 years ago, the critically acclaimed TV show The Wire depicted a Baltimore awash with a sea of drugs and guns that the police were almost powerless to control. Sadly, the reality is that the interplay between illegal drugs and firearms continue to feed a vibrant iron river of firearms that flow south and drugs that flow north. It is estimated that there are some 393 million guns in the United States. We, in fact, have more guns than people. And in the face of the all-too-frequent mass shootings in this country, the political debate turns to whether additional gun control measures will simply restrict the ability of law-abiding Americans to defend themselves.
But this debate overlooks how a regulatory structure deeply affected by Second Amendment consideration has proven vastly inadequate to deal with a potent mix of drugs, guns, and money. How do so many guns that are made by legitimate companies and sold through licensed dealers end up in the hands of gangs or cartels? What are the economics of the interplay between drugs and guns in this country and in Mexico? What tools can law enforcement deploy, and how have those tools been limited? Author Ian Grillo is a New York Times contributing writer based in Mexico who has taken a deep dive into that iron river with his new book, Blood, Gun, Money. We're very lucky to have Mr. Grillo with us this morning. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Great to be here. How are you doing?
Doing great. So, the book is filled with interviews of some fascinating characters. How did you come to write this book? How did you get those people to talk to you? And how long did it take?
So I've been based in Mexico for 20 years. I came here from the UK. And I found myself over the years reporting on this immense violence and what I would describe as a hybrid war, a hybrid conflict, a kind of mix of crime and war. Which has been a real humanitarian catastrophe with so many piles of mass corpses and massacres and shootouts and so forth. And within this, you know, for many years, I've been talking to criminals as well as families of victims and many parts of society and federal agents on both sides of the border about this situation. And I realized that we have to talk to the criminals on the street to get a sense of this. So with this book, which I began in 2017, it's my third book, and it began really with an interview I did in prison in Ciudad Juarez about somebody who was trafficking firearms from the United States into Mexico, and he explained how he was doing an entire modus operandi, really. He was doing an eight-year stretch for firearms trafficking, and then after that, it took me into a four-year journey of just trying to learn everything I can about guns, about the black market of guns, and about how these guns are trafficked in such huge numbers.
In the book, you discuss the shooting of Jaime Zapata in Mexico. Can you share with the audience a bit about their story and what it tells us about how weapons like the Kalashnikovs flow through the economy?
Yeah, sure. So Jaime Zapata was an agent for ICE, for the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the U.S. agency. Which is, you know, quite a controversial agency in recent years because of the mass deportations. But they were actually also involved in monitoring drug cartels, in monitoring human trafficking cases, so people forcibly trafficked and so forth. And they have people stationed in Mexico. Two of these agents, Victor Avila, Jaime Zapata, were driving up to collect some equipment, some wiretapping gear, and they drove up and then were ambushed and attacked by a group of a drug cartel called the Cetas cartel. And Jaime died in Mexico. He was then buried in his hometown in Brownsville. Victor Avila survived and still lives today with these quite severe bullet wounds. And in that case, because these were American federal agents who were attacked, there was a lot more effort to track the guns used, which they recovered some of the guns used in that attack in detail. And these were firearms manufactured all over the world in Romania, in the Cujir factory in Romania, which I went to. I traveled to Romania, in Transylvania, of all places, the home of Dracula, and one of them was known as the Draco gun, but were imported into the United States. So were put into the United States, and it's an interesting kind of story about how Kalashnikovs kind of went from this Soviet weapon of war to be marketed as sporting rifles in the United States. And then what I see is you have in the United States the massive legal retail firearms and then this massive black market parallel. And there's like an invisible line where guns cross from the legal market into the black market. And you saw that in the case of two weapons in this attack in Texas, one at a pawn shop where a guy walked in and bought 10 identical AK-47s, and one at a gun show. And that's where they crossed in to become into the hands of the setas.
The story is quite striking, and particularly what happens to Victor afterwards, when in the sense that he is sort of not sort of given a hero's welcome, notwithstanding the fact that he survived a pretty brutal attack.
Yeah, there's a lot of sad things there. You know, he survived these bullets. He had to leave his home. He was worried. I mean, even about being in hospital in Mexico because the gunman can come in and finish people off. And then he didn't get a very warm and, as you say, a good treatment from ICE. He ended up involved in a lawsuit suing people, including naming his ICE bosses for negligence, and eventually went out of the agency on a medical discharge. And also, as it came out, as he was kind of challenging the government agencies on this, this big scandal came out known as Fast and Furious, which is where the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, the gun police were like watching firearms be trafficked to Mexico with the idea of busting them. But that was a big scandal under the Barack Obama presidency. And that was a big thing, which I look into in quite a lot of depth in the book. I think one of the real sad things, though, that came out of all of this was that this was 2011. And in the 10 years since then, you know, actually there was kind of efforts to try and stop the trafficking really faltered. And there's been an estimated more than 2 million firearms since then have been trafficked to Mexico. And, you know, there's been really record deaths here south of the border.
With the goal being to reduce trafficking, you know, what was or what is the significance of the 1986 Firearm Owners Protection Act and what it's been its impact on law enforcement?
So I think, I mean, before I went into the book, I was of the idea, I think that, well, you know, you've just this very, very strong Second Amendment and, the laws in the United States about guns are quite clear. And as the more research I did, I found out that actually the laws are, it's a kind of crazy mosaic of rules and regulations in the United States about guns. And, you know, a lot of confusion about this, even among policemen themselves and people in the gun industry. So you're going back to the Second Amendment and all of these different laws and then going to the 1934 Act, the 1968 Act, and the 1986 Act. And I think this kind of back and forth. Now, one of the things about 1986 was under Ronald Reagan was like knocking back on previous attempts at more secure gun regulation. And so one of the things that did was it had these rules that you cannot have a searchable database for firearms owners, the idea that if there's a database, then people will kind of go and take people's guns. But this creates this kind of quite surreal situation, and that often police don't understand this, that when they literally find smoking guns at crime scenes, like you arrive there, the gun's been dumped, the body's on the ground, they've got the serial number, they phone up the ATF, and when they phone up the ATF, say, we want a search on the gun, give us the owner. And say, well, we can't do that, that's against the law. We don't have a searchable database. And I went to the ATF National Tracing Center in West Virginia, which is quite a surreal site where they have these big, big piles of paper and they have to make these phone calls and kind of to try and trace using manual methods because they're not allowed by law to have a searchable database. And the average trace time is 11 days, which is quite a lot in a murder scene. So you see these kind of other, quite interesting things in the back and forth over gun regulation and over how to govern firearms in the United States. And it's not only really, I think, affecting the rights, which the book is not in any sense an attack on the Second Amendment or about the rights of Americans to have guns, is looking at what are the laws involved and how come actual basic law enforcement is often not working and how kind of dysfunctional the system is in many ways.
I have to say that the image that you paint of the Martinsville ATF National Tracing Center is almost Dickensian, stacks of paper and people, pawing through them. The idea that this is how we deal with guns in the 21st century is, strikes me as quite bizarre. And again, one of the gripping things about the book. A minute ago, when we were talking about Zapata, you mentioned gun shows. And another wonderful image that you have in the book is about the Las Vegas, the SHOT Show. Tell the audience a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the SHOT Show is the biggest firearms trade show in the world. Happens to be very close to the biggest mass shooting in recent American history, when the shooter in the hotel in Las Vegas shot at the Las Vegas Village concert venue. But the Las Vegas SHOT Show is this huge, sprawling show selling guns, gun equipment, anything to do with firearms, mainly to gun people in the gun industry, so to gun shops themselves, and to people buying for police departments, military departments around the world. So it's a real kind of look at the inside of the firearms industry. And the way it's kind of a cross between them, I mean, the firearms industry is a curious thing, because in some ways it's like any other kind of consumer industry. There's a big thing of product placements in films. They have, you know, guns. They have a sub-industry of people who will try and take certain firearms for manufacturers and get them placed in movies and so forth. On the other side, it's a very much more martial, military thing. So it's kind of the cross between, you know, what the firearms industry is really like. And then you have these Kalashnikovs, you know, AK-47s that were used in this attack. You have them on display there, and much more kind of martial weaponry there.
In Baltimore, you used your observations of characters, which were fascinating, people like Jelly Roll and Chain, to focus on three things: the mechanics of gun violence, the central relationship between guns and drugs, and the incredible degree of Baltimore gun violence. Tell us a bit about the lives these characters lead and how they informed your story.
Yeah, so, Baltimore's one of the emblematic places, I think, of gun violence in the United States. Now, by the numbers, actually, St. Louis, Missouri, has got even a higher number per capita, but that's a fairly small town, and Baltimore's a more sizable city, and also very much an example of trafficking, because the guns in Baltimore, a very large amount of the firearms are being trafficked from other states. So this movement of gun trafficking, this Iron River, it flows around the United States, and it flows over the border to Mexico and beyond, in fact, to more than 130 other countries. So Baltimore's got a very distinct patterns of drug selling, which goes back many years. It's very much a retail area for heroin, particularly, going back many decades. And there's a lot of money being generated then, which is then creating this violent competition. I mean, Jelly Roll, who was the guy who was showing me around, but himself had been a dealer on the corner when he was 17 years old in high school, was making $3,500 a week standing on the corner selling heroin and crack. So you see this very, very large amounts of money that's being generated, and then competition for that. So the demand for guns to protect that kind of money, and then you get a situation where young and some older people selling drugs and other people connected to that are shooting each other in very, very high rates. And then these dealers bringing in, having the whole business selling firearms. So, I mean, for me, it's quite incredible the level of violence in the United States and these islands of the United States, and how, despite the fact that the U.S. can have the biggest economy in the world still and the biggest military on the planet and be such a powerful country in some ways, can still have these levels of violence that are comparable to some of the cities that I cover in Latin America, in Mexico and Latin America.
Before we leave Baltimore, one of the things that made me smile as I was reading the book was, as I was reading these stories that sounded very much like The Wire, you then say that you're going to meet somebody named Barksdale, and it sounds like that's going to be a nickname based on this show. Tell the audience a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, and this is quite a sad ending to this anecdote, actually, because I arrived in Baltimore and I'd spoken to this guy, Jelly Roll, by phone. I've been introduced to him by somebody else, and it works in TV. And he works in security for film sets sometimes, as well as security in nightclubs. And I asked him about, you know, if he could introduce me to people who sell guns and drugs in the city. And he said, we'll see what happens. And when I arrived there, the first thing he does is say, well, we're going to meet Mr. Barksdale. So I thought he was joking at first, did Barksdale, I knew they were in The Wire. But it turned out there is really a criminal family known as the Barksdales. That they use the real name of this family in the TV series. So we go and meet this guy, Dante Barksdale, who's a very interesting character, who's been in prison for heroin, who's based, he's actually inspires the nephew character called D'Angelo in the series. His real name is Dante. And he mentions to me he wants to write his own book about his experiences and so forth. And Jerry Ross is a good guy to meet, to kind of move around in the city. He's a very influential figure. Earlier this year, he did release his book that he wrote. And on that same day, he was murdered. And so he was shot dead. I think it might well have been the idea of speaking too much, of telling too much publicly about this. So he was actually became one of the homicide victims of gun violence himself.
So, yeah, some of the simplicity in which you're, you know, bringing kind of to light the connection between guns and drugs and money, you know, are so simplistic, but they're still blowing me away. So oftentimes I'm just more hesitant when it comes time for a question. But what I'm wondering, can you share with the audience a bit about the different ways that guns flow from manufacturers to gangs and cartels and the role played by a gun or a drug barter?
Yeah, sure. So a couple of things there. Firstly, you have, like I say, this kind of legitimate legal retail market and this parallel black market. They cross that invisible line. I would say there's four main ways. The first is known as straw buyers, where somebody with a clean record is paid to go into a gun shop and buy a gun. They're very not very hard sentences for this. They're generally probation if people get caught doing this. The only crime is lying on the form, and that's one of the things I discovered. There is no federal crime of firearms trafficking in the United States. The second is known as the private sale loophole, which is where people who say, well, they're just regular collectors are selling guns privately, so there's no paperwork involved. Actually, this is documented, this is abused by people who are moving large amounts of guns. You know, in some cases, one person I looked at sold more than 1,000 guns this way into the black market to criminals when it was, you know, same, just a regular collector, you know, who just likes to collect guns. And then the third is people stealing guns, which often you have quite slack measures of security in some places. And there's videos of people going in and taking guns away from unlocked safes. And the fourth one is ghost guns, which now has become an issue in the news. President Joe Biden did bring this up, which is buying kits off the internet and assembling what the ATF call unserialized self-improvised firearms. They have some technical name for ghost guns. The bartering is interesting. So when I looked at the mechanics of the black market gun trade and how dealers determine their prices selling guns on the black market, I found these various what I call gunonomics kind of rules of black market firearms. But one thing is there's often trading between guns and drugs. So I looked at one gun dealer was bringing guns in from New England, a guy called Billy Jack Curtis. He'd been in a prison gang, and then as the Dirty White Boys, he was buying guns or acquiring guns in small towns, taking them to the cities and exchanging them for drugs. And you see these very elastic prices of both drugs and guns in the black market. And so the way they can be traded and both people are kind of making up money and then selling them on for bigger profits. And you see there's all chains in this. You see this down in Colombia where these guerrilla groups are also involved in producing cocaine, then exchanging drugs for guns. You see this on the Mexican-US border, and you see this on the streets of Baltimore.
One of the other anecdotes that you mentioned that caught my eye was this notion of people in this private sale context of doing a private sale and then turning around and having arranged with the buyer to claim that the goods were stolen so they could both get the profit from selling the gun and claim insurance on it. Is that really a common thing?
Well, this is an anecdote given to me by this trafficker from Baltimore, and it sounds like a scam that would be effective. He was actually using the straw buying, so saying to somebody, go to gun store, here's a couple of $1,000, go and buy a bunch of guns, take out insurance, claim the guns have been stolen, you get the insurance money back, so you make money that way, and they've also got a claim the guns were stolen, so somebody's not eligible for being done for straw buying. So it's a pretty effective thing, and a lot of the criminals are quite entrepreneurial about this, but also exploiting a system which is just so easy to exploit. I mean, you don't have to be a genius to be trafficking guns within the United States.
You point out as a policy matter, drugs and guns are approached as different problems. What kind of comprehensive policies could you talk about to look at the problems jointly, or how could we look at those problems jointly?
Yeah, I think a lot of these deep problems that are in the United States and in the hemisphere, I mean, you know, guns moving to Mexico, the Mexican drug war, all of these things, which are very deep problems. And politics, I think, is quite broken and is, you know, for some time has not been practical about fixing things. But we need to look at these as long term and not totally separate areas. The issue of drug selling, you know, is handled by one department in the United States. The issue of violence is by another. So I think we have to have a basic philosophy of reducing the worst aspects of this for both guns and drugs. So the idea before with drugs that there would be a complete abolition of drugs from American life, that was the phrase put out by Richard Nixon back in 1971 when he began the kind of war of drugs idea. I think we've seen that's been a failure.
Before we go, and I'd like to finish, you mentioned that politics is broken. You described the politics of gun control as being dominated by radical positions. Can you briefly talk before we go a little bit about how these positions are manifested, and is there any way out of this?
Yes. I mean, so with the politics of gun control, I think we've seen the radical positions, particularly inside the some elements of the NRA, which dates back to the 1970s, the radicalization of the NRA. And in some ways, selling a lifestyle and being against any regulation whatsoever, which is not historically the position of the NRA back to the 1960s or 1930s or so forth. And then you get it, you know, coming to other, you know, any other side, some idea that we can't, you know, deal with anybody at all, with anybody having a gun is a real radical. So I think there's a lot of room in the middle for the kind of quite common sense measures on this. I mean, things like simply the universal background checks, which is supported by 89% of Americans and 81% of gun owners, things like tightening issues on the straw buy. A lot of these things could have a really, really big effect on the law, and really, I think it would be very reasonable things that could be a consensus on to try and find a better way forward on this.
So thank you for joining us. The book is Blood, Gun, Money by Ion Grilla. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. Thank you for joining us. Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.
You've been listening to Mountain Money on KPCW.